Welcome to the Pathfinder Podcast, brought to you by Shillington, where we talk to creators about how they navigated their design careers from the early beginnings up until now, and the twists and turns along the way. I'm Jimmy Muldoon, designer and teacher at Shillington's New York campus. Glad you could join us.
All right, so we've got Luke Bone with us today. So, Luke, can you kind of like give us a bit of a background to, you know, where you grew up and maybe just some of that, those experiences of design or creativity when you were, you know, when you were younger and so forth?
Yeah, for sure. I guess it's, for me, I think I could kind of go back pretty far. And maybe I will, but I won't linger in the past too long. But I think generally my upbringing was always in a pretty creative atmosphere, and a pretty, if not atmosphere, then at least a creative foundation. I think because mostly, you know, both of my parents have kind of a creative background. They're both theater majors. And more specifically, my dad went to school for the graphic arts, and I kind of picked up on that, I think, early, maybe even just through exposure, just sort of like observing, you know, because he had a design office in the town that we were living in, and you know, whether it was just me being babysat in his office. Or like observing kind of the things he would do on the computer at home, you know, I think maybe without realizing that he's doing something creative, I was seeing him do something creative on a pretty routine basis. And when it came time to consider, you know, that, you know, designing, creating, producing something that came out of your own head is an option and is something you can do. I think I was hopefully what had happened was I was kind of primed for that kind of mode of creative thought. I was probably the first of my friends to have like Photoshop on our home computer. Frankly, I was probably the first of my friends to have a Macintosh computer in our house growing up. I mean, back then, I guess this was like in the 90s, and back then they were expensive. They were unnecessary unless you were using them for kind of a creative profession. So most people had different versions of a PC if they had a home computer at all.
Yeah.
So I guess I kind of started to realize a little bit, like as I went through kind of middle school, developing kind of like you know, friends with you know, I guess we would go to shows, we would skateboard, we would kind of want to kind of lean into the kind of subcultures of like expressing yourself, obviously by being kind of a little punk kid, but also to like what kind of patches do you sew on your backpack, what kind of stickers do you put on your skateboard. And like the moment we realized we could make stuff ourselves, and I say we, I mean like me and my friends, and I was like, oh, I've got Photoshop, you know, let me draw this up and I'll paint it in, and then we can like take it to this like, you know, little like athletic print shop down the street and have them like, you know, heat transfer a graphic onto a t-shirt and then we'll wear it to school. And just the idea of making something for yourself, I think, was pretty thrilling. But then I guess going into high school, I grew up in a part of Maryland, that had a lot of different kinds of, I guess, towns and counties that, like, they're pretty close in proximity. But what I started to gather kind of quickly was that the high school I went to did have a pretty dynamic arts department. And I think I look back on that pretty thankfully, because I know that if I didn't have the access to such a wide range of different kinds of art classes, as well as graphic design classes, which they weren't called graphic design classes. They were like different increments of the idea of graphic design, but generally learning how to navigate software in an intuitive way. Mm. but as well as like, you know, like ceramics classes and drawing and painting classes and, you know, working on the yearbook committee as the designer and learning how to lay out a page and just kind of like discovering that like, oh, I can apply these principles of creative thought and artistic thought into a practical setting, was something that I picked up in high school. And I think from there, I wasn't really good at a lot of other things. Like I definitely was struggling to like hang on to passing grades in my math and science classes. And like, meanwhile, like all that struggle, like the sort of shining hope was, I just got to hang out in the art department. Like, I just have to stay here. Let me just like, this feels right. It feels natural. My teachers keep telling me I'm doing all right. So let me just stay the course. And I think that from there, one of my teachers in high school just kind of like pointed me in the direction of art colleges. Mm-hmm. And I only applied to maybe three different colleges in Maryland. And one of them was the Maryland Institute College of Art, which is in Baltimore. And I went there and applied, got accepted. And I only remember that my parents were freaked out about how expensive the tuition was. And I thankfully got some scholarship money. And, you know, I feel like this kind of goes back to like, I'm already throwing us on a tangent here, but this kind of goes to this idea that kids are making decisions about their professional futures before they even know what the hell they're talking about. And I think like, that's so fascinating to me. And I think I just kind of rolled the dice and got lucky that I kind of knew that I wanted to go into design. But frankly, at that point, I probably, if you asked me what I was going to be when I grew up, I don't think I'd have a clear answer. Like, I think it was just that, like, I don't know. I'm enjoying learning software. I'm enjoying designing posters. I'm enjoying making t-shirts with my friends. Like, let me just kind of keep riding this wave and we'll see where it takes us.
Yeah.
And that was the momentum that started it. And I majored in graphic design at MICA, and it's been a relatively linear path to this point. Although there have been deviations in terms of exactly how I want to apply graphic design, which I suppose we can unpack during this conversation. But in a nutshell, that's my background, and that's kind of how like growing up around graphic design led me to becoming a graphic designer.
Mm. It's interesting that even just thinking about what you're talking about, you know, being exposed to art, you know, ceramics and so forth. Do you find that there's an element of that being exposed to the art side of things and how that influences you still today? Is that, you know, with how you, you know, go about a job or anything, do you kind of draw back to those art days or art history or?
Yeah. I mean, short answer, yes, absolutely, yeah. Totally. I think it happens in different ways.
Yeah.
Personally, I enjoy making, I guess I wouldn't call it art, but I enjoy drawing and I enjoy taking pictures and I enjoy, I think just the act of creation, of making something that you had an idea about first and then finding a way to put things together until it takes shape and actually exists in front of you. Like that's a really exciting thing. And I think that even when it's not a professionally oriented task, like even if I'm not told to do it and it's just something like, you know, I love the way that the light passes through my glass of water and the way that the color that comes out of it just lands on the, you know, casts a shadow and the reflection is twisted. And, you know, you just kind of get excited and motivated about just the things you see around you. I think it just trains you to be both objectively and subjectively mindful about the potential of things, because our jobs are literally to create something that doesn't exist yet, or to build on something that does exist, but in a direction it's never gone before. Mm-hmm. And I think you just kind of, you use your footing in the arts to just kind of remind yourself that there's a lot more to be done and we're always moving forward, which is kind of exciting. So it kind of helps you kind of, I don't know, I guess kind of lean into the creative side of what we're doing.
Yeah. It's interesting because I find, and I think you touched on it definitely there with like creating art or photography, it is a really nice thing as a designer to create something or make something that doesn't have an objective, a brief objective where yeah. someone is going to say, this is a successful piece. Like it's nice yeah. to kind of have that avenue and create something just really weird. Like capture a shot that's bizarre that you're like, this definitely wouldn't fit a typical brief or art direction for anything, but it's, you know, or even making pottery or painting or drawing, you can create stuff that's it's kind of weird that no one's, yeah. like no client's going to see and go, you missed the point completely. Like
absolutely.
Those avenues are, I'm finding are so needed more and more these days mm-hmm. than ever. And it's a recharging yeah. kind of channel that I find. Do you find the same?
I do. Yeah. I do. And I think one of those early kind of creative principles that kind of entered my purview was probably this idea that process is really important and perhaps more important than the outcome, which is the foundation of many fine artists and their careers. This sort of endless pursuit of the more specific version of what I just made. Like, how do I make my point more clearly? Like, I think I like what I just made, but I'm going to try again. I'm going to do it a little yeah. differently this time.
Yeah.
But even non-artists, when we deal with branding and with just the iterative craft of design, I think there is this idea that like, it's dangerous to think that there's a finish line and that, you know, an outcome that you arrived at on a Tuesday at 3 p.m. any given week is going to be the end all be all symbol for a company for an indefinite amount of time. That it's absurd. And that would never be the case. I think we have to remember and train our clients and train our own minds that like, it's healthy to not be interested in the conclusion and to like preferably be more interested in, you know, incremental growth and the inspiration that emerges when you kind of push something a little further. Mm. You know, I find what we're talking about to be motivating for sure. Mm. I think that's probably just what kind of keeps me excited about starting any new project. You know, you kind of, it can be overwhelming at the beginning, because you don't know where to begin. But I think once you get started, you approach all of these forks on the road and the forks never end. You know, you keep getting these new options. You're like, well, maybe I could take it this way, or maybe it goes that way. And depending on the direction I take, like we're going to go down a very different path. You know, you start to talk about combinations of things, and you can only really learn what's going to work the best once you start exploring like combinations and, you know, lots of trial by fire and lots of, you know, I think about just those moments where you're working and like, whether it's Illustrator and you've been working in this file for a week and you zoom out real far and it's like all these trash ideas you've had all week, but there's all these nuggets of gold and all of these like, just all of these drafts where it's like, if you had anyone glance at your computer screen, it'd be like, wait, what's the difference between all of these? But to you, it's crystal clear. Mm. Or like a InDesign file where you're designing a poster and every page is a slightly different modification to the layout. And, you know, it's an 80 page long document and you kind of remember where all the little turning points were along the way. You don't delete anything because you never know if you're going to want to go back and check in on something again, or you leave these little bread trails for yourself. But I think that's what's fun about what we do. And I think that's where you find the best stuff for sure. It's all granular, but I think it adds up in a big way once you realize what you're doing.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's, I experienced that last week, you know, designing something is like, you know, hitting roadblock after roadblock is just not working. It's just not working. It's just not working. And then it's like just taking a step back or leaving it for a day. And just, and it's even to the point, like I just removed one element that I thought I needed. And I was like, oh my goodness. Like, you know, I'm off again. Like you're off on a tangent. You just, you kind of hit those roadblocks without kind of like thinking about it and pushing through. You know, I could have just left and gone, okay, that will do. But then hitting that roadblock and then making a decision, like just a quick decision, you know, it didn't have to be drastic, you know, just quickly designing something or removing something, you know, you're off on your way again. And you're like, oh, you start running again. You get that momentum. It's, for you know, sure. you can't, it's an invigorating feeling that designers, that's why
absolutely.
We design.
And I think it's totally healthy. It's like fitness. I mean, it's like, you know, when you are given the opportunity to expand on an idea, which, you know, I wonder what it would be like to be a design student today and be thinking specifically, I mean, differently than 12 years ago, being in a classroom and designing. And I think probably the biggest difference based on students I've had recently and the sorts of projects that we're making, it's like you can't just stop with this little capsule of elements for a design assignment. Like a lot of times it has more to do with the culture you're engaging and the audience you're engaging and being almost like responsive or reactive to virtually everything that your customer might engage with in their life, in their daily life, because your brand might have something to do with that, or it might influence the way someone engages with the next thing. And especially with social media and different modes of communication, you know, you can't just keep saying the same thing the same way, you know. And even when something is really successful, even when something really hits, you still have to elaborate on what you meant by that. You still have to shine a different light on it or take a variable and switch it out for something else and see what that does to your brand. And I think it's a healthy mode of thinking that, like, you know, you're the best brands are always shape-shifting and are always engaging in the same culture their customer is engaging with, because you know, you got to be on the pulse. Everything's moving so quick and there's so many places for design to exist. I don't know. I don't remember what the basis of that was, but I think it all comes back to this idea of like forks in the road. Like you said, hey, I removed something I thought was critical, and all of a sudden it's like, oh shit, look what we can do now. Like it's almost like you backpedaled, you went in reverse for a second back to that fork in the road, and now you went a different way.
I think it's just re-questioning it, you know, questioning, do I actually need this? Is this essential? Yes or no? No. Okay, let's remove it and see what happens. So do you, how did you find yourself at choosing which kind of, you know, design kind of focus? You know, did you just go with branding first and you've done that, or what's that journey been like for you, you know, since, you know, your career or, you know, through college?
It's a good question. I think I don't think branding was the point for me at first. I think that wasn't like a, like, I think the idea of branding is a relatively recent idea. I think like Wolf Olins did a lot of work with design and marketing in like 2007 and 2008 and going into the 2010s, where you started to see a lot of these, I mean, I'm going to say brands, but I don't think I would have said that before. I think I would have said companies with, you know, campaign strategies or design systems that were rooted more in this idea of being a platform for rich content that when paired with the brand would equal a different outcome. Mm. And I think then they were calling them flexible brands. Like when they did the AOL rebrand, mm. That was like this really, I think that particularly for me was a big moment where I realized like, oh, the logo is less important than the content the brand is representing. And in the case of the AOL rebrand, it was like the whole premise of it, as I recall, was that you can't see AOL until the content shows up behind it. And then you realize it was there all along. Mm. Which was this sort of heady idea for what a logo could be. But as epic and as grand an idea as that is, it also boiled down so quickly to like, you know, when you think on a big scale like that, you no longer need like this really ornamental logo. Like it no longer needs to have a unique shape that like, because it's not just fighting for attention on shelf space with just a logo anymore. Now it's like these platform brands where it's like, you know what? The content we have is actually more of our brand than our logo is. Let's just, you know, and there's this whole, on this over here, there's this whole tangent of this whole idea that a lot of designers are grumpy about these days, which is, you know, that logo design has plummeted and the quality of logos and the craft of logos has become boring or bland. Mm. I sympathize with the artistic end of that complaint, but I don't think I care for the concern that the logo matters as much as what the brand is offering or doing. And I think Wolf Olins started to demonstrate that to me during the turn of the decade. And I think that's when, that is also when I took a job in advertising, just to get back to your question about kind of what was the trajectory. And I think when I was in design school, I didn't think as much about the application of the things I was learning. Like I didn't think about the, like I knew about pentagram design and I knew about 2x4 and I knew about Sagmeister and I knew that there were offices that produced graphic design products that I was attracted to, but I didn't necessarily think about like, where will I work when I graduate, you know, where will I apply these skills? Like that's such a professionally minded, mature thought that I don't think I was capable of thinking when I was just leaving college. And so I ended up accepting a job in advertising, which when I look back, I kind of realized like, it's really surprising that happened because I don't think any of, or very few of my peers from design school went to an ad agency after graduating. I think the more linear path is to go to a graphic design company where you are quite literally applying the fundamentals of what you've learned at school to a project. Mm-hmm. But I went into advertising. I joined a team at Leo Burnett and I moved from Baltimore to Chicago. And I think I was more excited about exploring a new city and just the sort of the shock of jumping into the cold water without wading into it first. You know what I mean? Like, I just want to try something totally different. I've never even been to Chicago before, but here I am. taking a job in it and in an industry that I guess is familiar, but is largely very different than what I'm used to seeing. But it's lots of glitz and glamour, and the volume is up really high, and everyone's excited, and there's just all this creativity everywhere. And it was definitely like a really fascinating experience, but one that turned a little bit fatiguing, unfortunately, quickly. I'm far enough away from that part of my life where I'm not bitter anymore. But I do think that at the time I was very frustrated, like a year or two into working in advertising, where I think I just realized that, like, while design is important in advertising, it's not the most important thing. And I'm not even sure if brands are the most important thing in advertising. Unfortunately, my opinion about that culture is that it tends to be more about a very vacuum sealed idea that lives and dies in a campaign. And I don't think that a campaign is a brand. I think a campaign is a way of marketing a part of a brand or a product that came from a brand. Mm-hmm. But I think that is not a healthy way of approaching sustainable design. And I think I just got a little bit confused about, like, what am I trying to do here? What am I really ever going to achieve in advertising? And I think that that's when I started really lifting my head up from my computer screen and really thinking about a bit more clearly, like, what are my options? Like, when I think about what I want to do, is this it, or is there something else I could be doing? And I think that's when I started to really research, like, smaller design companies, few of which are in Chicago. It's a pretty intimate design culture in Chicago, and I do miss that, being there and realizing that you can really meet, you know, all the heavy hitters in the design scene in that city pretty quickly, which is cool. But I also, it was inhibiting because there weren't really many other options for employment. And so that was when I started to look towards, like, all right, well, maybe if I want to transition, maybe I need to be in a new city like New York. I know, like, looking for your first job out of school is something that's important to Shillington. And I think talking about, like, that sort of experience of interviewing and all that is also critical. That's kind of where, like, this segue would happen in this particular tale. I think going to New York was really exciting because there was a lot of different opportunities for, like, do you work for a small design company? Do you work for a larger company that is design rooted but does more marketing? So maybe it's a little bit closer to the advertising side of things, but isn't quite an ad agency. Do you work in-house? I think at that time, and I guess at this point, this was like 2012, brands, I think the idea of a startup brand and the idea that an in-house team could be as powerful as a advertising agency or a design company could be, I think that was a relatively new cultural thought. And so the option of working in-house for a brand was newly on my radar. But yeah, I mean, I basically went from advertising to, I ended up working at MoMA. I joined their design team to do marketing work and identity work for exhibitions, as well as just sort of evergreen collateral for the museum. I worked there for a couple years before I had the idea to start doing freelance for myself. I think when I talk about this sort of thing, it's easy to forget that, like, all the while I was doing freelance work. Like, I think like, this kind of goes back to our earlier conversation about the joy of creating. And I think that, like, there wasn't really ever a point where I wasn't curious about raising my hand and saying to, you know, whether it was like an art gallery or like a design studio that was, you know, hosting like a creative market where you could make something and promote it here or whatever. And I think there was always this idea that like, hey, can I make a poster for that? Or like, or do you need a logo? Cause I can make a logo. Can I make your logo? Like, and like the idea of being paid was cool, but like, it also wasn't even about that. It was just this, you're just sort of thirsty, you know? I fantasized about having my own design company at some point. So when I was at MoMA, when I decided that it was time to move on, that's what I had in mind. Mm. But that didn't last very long because around that same transition point, started talking with a company called Paperless Post, and I ended up joining their endeavors to be the creative director of what had just started happening then was them sort of developing a brand department in house. So I kind of came on to help them build that, help them kind of define what their visual brand could be. And so I guess that kind of represents a trajectory of applying design for mass marketing and an ad agency to applying it towards more niche marketing to a smaller community of people interested in particular art types to coming back out halfway to a more commercial landscape, but maintaining a very critical mind about what does a product mean to a customer and how do we keep talking to that customer again and again and again, rather than, you know, blaring from a megaphone to the general masses. And then Bone Design happened. And now I try to just sort of, run the gamut across a bit of an amalgamation of all of that, where it's like, we can behave small if that's the intention of the client that I'm working with. If you only want private clients, then we'll work in a very granular way and we'll engage a smaller audience. And that maybe that leaves room for more creativity. Mm-hmm. Because I think by being specific and being very pinpointing, you can elaborate on an idea more rather than summarizing a broader idea for a broader audience. But we do that too. You know, sometimes an assignment comes along and it's like, hey, we need to create a campaign that engages like any business owner that could benefit from our service. Mm. How do we make a statement that engages all of them at once? And that's a really exciting strategic challenge too. So Bone Design is kind of, is a graphic design studio, it's one of those things where I try to toggle between saying I and we. Some projects are collaborative, other projects are pretty sort of straight shooting, just I handle it myself. Overall the intention is just to kind of take a very focused approach to design and be purposeful and you know, embrace different settings and atmospheres and platforms and in a purposeful way.
So, you know, when a job comes across your desk, what is your creative process? I know it's probably different for every job, but, you know, just kind of wanted to unpack what that looks like for you.
Yeah. So I think for me, it can be very different depending on the nature of the work that we're dealing with. I find that a lot of times it's, first of all, many of the projects that I get are referral oriented. So whether that means a client I've had in the past recommended my service to a peer of theirs, and I onboard that new client with a kind of a lengthy conversation about generally what it is I do and how that can benefit their business, to other referral types where it's like, you know, a relationship with a creative director at a brand, who has an opportunity to do something different than the in-house team is normally acclimated to. One of those things for for Bone is spatial design, which I think taps into a little bit of my past experience with MoMA, designing for scale and designing for kind of a physical relationship with material and space. That's definitely a really exciting avenue, but also a very specifically complicated one, just because of the practical nature of what you're doing and making sure that what you're designing can really happen in a physical capacity. Those projects are obviously very different because they usually kick off with a bit more of a strategic conversation about the broader purpose of why this spatial design is about to happen in the first place, which I suppose taps into the bigger picture answer to your question, which is like, when you're dealing with brand design, you kind of have to face the question of why are we doing this in the first place at a pretty early stage in the process. And I think it's important because you can't, you know, for a number of reasons, it's important. Obviously, the most important reason is so that you understand what decisions you should be making and why it's important to, you know, reach a certain conclusion creatively, but also strategically. Like, you know, we're gonna use a certain kind of language that we know based on research I've been provided by the client. We know that a certain kind of language or vocabulary tends to convert an audience more successfully. Maybe that means that the language that we use and the vocabulary we use resonates with a certain subculture of people and their interests or their priorities. Or maybe it's a bit more about, you know, a company with a product that if only people understood what they could do with this product rather than their assumptions about it, then we believe that we can get them to shift their lifestyle to become more like this. And so then your job becomes a bit more still strategic, but more about kind of hypothesizing different simulations of like, well, all right, so we know that's your sort of your corporate goal. What can design do, whether it's pushing words forward and messages forward, or whether it's representing an idea graphically? You got to have those conversations early. And I think maybe that's probably the most average answer to your question, is like, projects come along and we generally start by having probably like a week or two, like over the course of the first 2 weeks, it's a series of conversations about asking big questions about the purpose of the business and the goal of a particular assignment, receiving that information, going off and kind of trying to sort of parse what I've learned, put sort of a playback presentation together to make sure I'm interpreting it clearly, and to also sort of start to prod at a few different ideas that are usually graphic design isn't part of this stage. It's usually just more like, suppose we went this way with it, or suppose we went this way with it. There are pros and cons to all of these scenarios. Let's try to kind of articulate which scenario gives us the best balance of all of the good parts that we're looking for. Mm. And usually the first 2 weeks of a project like that helps to sort of shine a light on that. And then I use that information and those decisions, those sort of micro wins, to run away with that. And then that actually becomes more helpful than the creative brief I was given in the first place. So then this becomes kind of like, all right, these are my ingredients. Now I'm going to go off and make a dish with it. And so the design part happens usually in the second stage of the project. But even then, I think it's important to be generous with how many different rocks you're turning over and how many different doors you're opening to look behind, but also be really specific about like where, like this almost starts to tap into like principles for design that I generally believe in, which which inform decision making at this stage of the creative process. I think it's like really important to think about what are the constants, what are those pillars of truth and those like principles that no matter what this brand does, as long as they're always engaging the same mission, these are things that will never change. They're usually non-visual, but as far as visuals are concerned, they're usually things that can inform like how reductive design should be to make way for a message or to make way for symbolism or whatever it is. Or should we always be carrying with us a reoccurring notion? And maybe there are many ways of representing a notion visually, but we always need to represent it at some point in the process. And so you kind of give yourself like a criteria to design with. That like as long as we're checking all these boxes somehow, then perhaps what we have right in front of us is a valid outcome. Mm. And so I think it's important to like set parameters. A metaphor I use some, or not a metaphor, an analogy I use a lot is like putting a fence in a yard. And like it can be a really big yard, but like as long as there's a fence and as long as we know the room we have to play in, we won't go outside of that fence. But perhaps anywhere we stand in the yard, as long as it's within the fence, could be a valid place to be standing, mm-hmm. A valid outcome creatively. But those fences are important.
Would you say that that's like that fence is kind of like that overall big idea, that concept, that thing that the client wants to get across? Like once you've kind of got that fence, then you can go and kind of play in that field.
Yeah, right. Because if you don't, without the fence in the yard, you might end up standing in the neighbor's yard. You know, you might end up flirting with a design solution that's actually inappropriate for your client. And no matter how beautiful it is, it's just not going to work, you know? And so I think it's important to, you know, just, you got to memorize the rules of the game before you start playing it.
It sounds like research is such a huge part of, you know, building that fence for yourself and, you know, knowing the parameters that you have to work within. Because mm-hmm. I think, as you said before, if you don't, you can end up anywhere and completely missing what the client wants to actually build and achieve.
Now, the other side of that coin is the fence is very helpful to the creative process, I think, because it is relieving to know that you only have so many options. I find relief in that. I love a good blank slate, but I think that I can tend to get a little frustrated or overwhelmed if I don't know, if I can't rule something out early. That's frustrating to me because I need to know generally where I shouldn't go, so that I can at least start from the origin point with a direction. Mm-hmm. And if I don't know what direction I should start in, a lot of times that leads to counterproductivity. A lot of times I don't get as much done, or rather we'll focus on the positive. I get more done when I know what the rules are.
Yeah.
I can be more productive down a path that's more fruitful if we define those rules earlier.
Do you kind of find with those projects, you kind of have a gut feeling to this is the way we should go? Is there something that kind of, is that kind of like gut feeling or that northern star of like, I really feel like this is where we should be going?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that happens too. I mean, I think sometimes the client knows generally where they want to be. More savvy clients, people that have been navigating their market for a longer amount of time or have maybe worked at companies doing what they are currently doing and now they're doing it differently, but generally still engaging the same marketplace. A lot of times those those clients have a better understanding of what would work for them. Yeah. And when they do, like when they have an answer like that, I listen. I think it's important to, like, I don't think that our job is to be stubbornly different. I don't think we're supposed to give them something surprising every time. I think that can be fun, but it also can be totally unnecessary. Sometimes a client is like, no, what you're showing me just won't work. It needs to be more like this. And that can be helpful. It can be humbling, but it can be really helpful because it clarity, I think, can just lead to the decision faster. And I don't think there's anything wrong with designing quickly if you know where you need to get quickly.
Yeah. It's great.
Then again, it can be really complicated. The only anecdote I would offer here is like, you know, I have, a year ago I was working with a private therapist whose clients were teenage girls transitioning from high school to college and therefore exiting the sort of parental roof and going into a young adulthood for the first time. And I think that there are certain topics that are reoccurring for that demographic. But also stylistically, she needed a brand and she knew, I know what my girls like and I need to be engaging their interests. Pretty literally, frankly, this isn't a brand for savvy, you know, technology startup people in San Francisco where you can be kind of lofty and figurative and still get a message across. Like, this is a really specific audience and I do need it to look a very specific way. So the fence in that yard was a little bit tighter.
Yeah.
But she knew that, like, there's a lot that wouldn't work and fewer things that will work, but at least that clarity helped me kind of focus from the start really clearly.
Yeah. It sounds like having a client that kind of has some idea is better than one that doesn't really have an idea. Is like maybe a catch 22 in that.
Yeah. I think when a client doesn't have maybe not as much idea, but maybe more like preference. Mm. Like if a client doesn't mind so much what their brand looks like, and if they're kind of leaving it up to you, you take on a kind of responsibility for their business in oftentimes a frightening way, where it's like, when I pitch three directions we'll just say a visual identity. If we're pitching three directions to what their logo could be, and if they were to choose logo A versus B versus C, you know, the graphic package that comes with that is going to be very different. And when you find yourself in a presentation like that, where the client is a bit on the indifferent side and they're like, well, I think they're all great. I think I like A and B more than C, but generally, like, that's why I hired you. So you tell me what I should use. That's not a very common moment, but I think sometimes it does happen, or variations of that do happen. And I think, that's when you're like, okay, well, I really, really need to make a reason-based decision. Like, I can't go off of my feeling because I run the risk of damaging your company and your revenue stream if we go the wrong way. So I'm only going to make a decision based on really rational conversation about why we should choose one over another. So you almost, like, if the client doesn't have a preference, you kind of have to, like, assume the responsibility of someone who's in charge for that company, so that you don't give them something that you know wouldn't work or would at worst damage what they're trying to do.
Yeah, it's a lot of responsibility. Yeah, it's a lot of weight to carry as a designer. What is one of the biggest lessons you've learned in your career?
I mean, coming off of that, that's That is one of them. I think to be very objectively minded about your decision making, for two reasons. The first reason is kind of an echo of the last part of this conversation. Mm-hmm. Generally that, like, if you can make your decisions about what design works the best, or what idea is going to be the most successful, mm. based not so much on your preferences or your, like, tastes or what seems to be in fashion right now. Like, if you don't base it on that, and you more likely base it on, like, the reason I'm doing this is because I believe it's going to work better, mm. or it's going to serve the brief better. For really objective reasons, that is, it's going to be a more successful outcome. But it also, I think working objectively helps you make decisions faster. I think when you're sort of sifting through stylish ideas or, like, ornamental work, it kind of, like, usually the there's more right answers than wrong ones, and it's up to you to just sort of decide that you're done because it feels right at this point. But I think that's a really dangerous approach to making decisions, because I generally feel a little bit differently about style, kind of on a more frequent basis. Like, I feel like I believe in the same principles longer term than I believe in styles. So I generally, like, I generally made a decision along the way that, like, you know what, this is how I'm going to design from now on. I'm going to move things around until I generally like how they're feeling, and then I'm going to round to the nearest objectively reasoned with outcome. And that's how I'm going to arrive this is what it needs to be. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's one big lesson. Probably the stress test that made that a lesson was when I was working at MoMA. I had a design director who I miss working with greatly because of the fact that working with him led to these sorts of epiphanies or these sorts of lessons. He approached design criticism from a very objective place. So, like, you know, if you pin up a dozen ideas, he's going to gravitate to the ones that seem to have evidence of, like, rational design thinking in them, mm-hmm. rather than ones that feel like they're just sort of ornamental or splashy for no good reason. And I think the reason he did that was because you can build on something that has an objective foundation, even if it's just a really clear, evident grid, you know, even if it's just the relationship of typography to image to negative space is just evidently living on a grid, mm-hmm. that can be objective thinking kind of at its most minor level. But at its most major level, it's like, let's say we draw a line down the middle of the spread from left to right, and it's dead center, and any typography that lives throughout the entire book always sits on that line, and there's going to be a margin around the whole spread that's, you know, the same thickness as the X height of the typography on the center line, and in that way we're going to define, like, you know, the space we have to play in, and every right-hand page is going to have a photo placed on it, but it's only going to appear within that central margin on the right side behind the headline, and then something on the left will be in front of the headline that'll be more organically placed. But you kind of start to define these, like, rules, and then you can fill in the blanks with whatever you want as long as you're never breaking those rules, and then you end up having this document that's like all of these unique outcomes that have a kind of obedience to one another, mm. and you create a design system. And I think like learning how to design like that, I don't think you can just say that to a designer and expect them to understand. I didn't. I had to learn by way of a lot of stressful late nights, showing my design director drafts of the same thing that I couldn't understand why he wasn't approving it. And it got to a point where I was like, I don't know how to do this. Maybe I'm not supposed to be a designer. I don't know. Am I like, what am I not understanding? And then finally you run into a breakthrough where it's like, wait, he likes this one. What's different about this one? Why is this one the one that he likes? And then you're forced to really surgically take it apart and be like, wait, what makes this different from all the other ones, aside from it being the most recent one? But like, and a lot of times I think when you really kind of work backwards and like break down what you made and why it's working, it starts to reveal these sorts of premises for like, oh, it's because I put rules in place. It's because I thought very carefully about why a certain framework will lead to a promising outcome. And I think that was the kind of lesson I learned in the process, to just sort of always approach your work objectively. That's sort of long-winded, but
no. That's fantastic. There's always those moments of handing something up to your creative director or your art director, or like real nervous, not knowing what's going to happen. And it's just like baptism by fire. And it's, you know, those moments of like finding
it's true too. You use the word nervous in that. And I think that there's a truth to the word nervous. I think it's a little bit of a litmus test throughout your career where it's like, when do I stop feeling nervous? Like when do I transition from fingers crossed, hoping my boss will approve this to actually, I'm going to pitch this to my boss. I'm not just going to show him a smattering of ideas and just hope he picks one. I'm going to know confidently which one will work the best, and I'm going to pitch it to him or her. And if they approve it, then they agree with me. It's more likely that they're going to talk to me about the sort of the dialogue of why I think it's going to work rather than what it looks like. And I think that's a much more interesting conversation to have. And there is this kind of shedding of skin that happens where you start to develop this confidence in your career that I think you only get through experience. I think at a certain point of experience, you start to learn or maybe just realize patterns of success in your design work where it's like the reason why all these things have worked versus the vast amount of stuff I've done that didn't work, you start to sort of just suss out like these are the things they all have in common, or I approached them in a very similar way. And I think there's some truth to like just sort of respecting the transition of don't be nervous about the work you're making, be confident about the work you're making because you understand what you're doing. Which is a really powerful transition. And I think that those lessons that I was describing, I think that was when that happened for me. I think sometimes you need to have a tough boss, you know, you need to maybe be lost a little bit so that you can break out of it. You can just keep pushing and just aggravate yourself to a point of like, finally, I made it. And you feel almost like, I think, relief. You know, the contrast of feeling stressed to feeling relief is such a reward that you want to understand where that relief came from. And I think that's where you realize you've learned a lesson.
Yeah, I think that we've all got those pivotal moments in our career of like that relief of, you know, yeah, my first art director was, yeah, he was like that. And he worked, I was in Melbourne, he was in Adelaide, and I have to send stuff to him. So it was even like, when there was no response on the chat, I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
the silent treatment, you're like, oh, what have I done? But
for sure.
Or like the message back is like, really? Like, oh, okay. I gotta I got to rethink this. And I think you touched on it really well, like why it works over then it looks pretty, you mm-hmm. know, really breaking that down. So for you, someone owns your own studio, you know, what do you look for in a designer if you're going to, you know, hire someone or bring someone on, you know, freelance for a, for mm-hmm. a project or full time?
I think there's not a simple answer. I think it's more about what I'm looking for at the time that I'm interviewing someone. Generally, I want to know that they have enough of a footing in the basics of design thinking that I can kind of leave them to interpret a task in a unique way. And I think that that's a really important part of the relationship between a director and a designer, is that, you know, they're not just there to be a production artist. They are there to interpret and execute multiple interpretations of what you've asked them to do. So in that way, I think it's important that someone's portfolio demonstrates that capability of being able to like prove an idea out, and hopefully through the course of a portfolio showcase a kind of consistency in being able to do that. But more likely the person that I hire would be somebody that I have a good chemistry with, because the kind of work that I do and I think the kind of process that I go through to reach the end of a project is something that is pretty organic and pretty dialogue oriented. And I think that it's important that, you know, just as important, if not more important than being a already good designer, is the sort of interest and enthusiasm in and just wanting to talk about an idea and discuss it. And not necessarily have a point that I'm trying to make all the time, but like know that I'm talking to someone who is open to just extrapolating thought and looking at a sketch and discussing why it's interesting, even if it's ugly, and talking about like what the potential of it could be if we were to push it in one direction or another. And I think I've definitely worked with designers that don't have a lot of patience for that kind of conversation, and who would more rather just reach the conclusion as quickly as possible. And I think that that's fine in certain circumstances. But if we're asking what's the kind of designer that I would hire, it would be the kind of person that wants to discuss the process of the idea, like who wants to linger in that ether of creativity a little bit longer. You know, and only craft the final thing when we're sure that we've discovered it. That's a really interesting kind of creative thinker. I think that's the kind of person I would want to hire.
That's great. Thank you so much for sharing all this incredible insight with us. So last thing, you know, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can go to the Bone Design website, which is bone.nyc. That's where you'll find our work and a little bit about the studio. You can also find us on Instagram. Our handle is bone.nyc.design. And that's basically it. Those are the two most important places. Yeah, find us there.
Yeah, you don't have a a TikTok account yet?
Not yet. Oh, yeah. I think I've been consciously avoiding that because I'm fearful of new things. I'm forced into it, I probably won't.
If you've got a dog, you need a TikTok account. So, you know, maybe during this time, you can kind of like dabble in it, and maybe when we circle back around, we can talk about those.
Okay.
Excellent.
All right, deal.
Excellent. Thank you so much again for your time and always being so willing to to help the grads and the young designers out there really kind of learn and grow and push their careers forward with all of that insight that you've got. So thank Absolutely. You so much for all your time. We really appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you for the conversation, Jimmy. I hope this Excellent. Is helpful to the students.
It definitely will be, I know it.
The Pathfinder podcast has been brought to you by Shillington, the original graphic design bootcamp. To learn more about the podcast and Shillington, click the link in the bio. Show your support by subscribing and rating us on your preferred podcast platform. Original music composed and performed by Menakshi. Thanks for listening.